common assumption operating behind the psychoanalytic endeavour that the past is somehow malleable, that while it largely holds its shape, it's not hardened like concrete. Intrinsic to this assumption is the notion that the past isn't dead but still alive, which has also become linked to the idea of the unconscious as something timeless. You could even say modern neuroscience buys into this very idea with a notion of neuroplasticity. What emerges out of this assumption is the hope that somehow there is a way of reprocessing our past experiences, that we can derive healthier meanings from this, enable it to sit better with us, that there is some way of changing how we feel about our difficult past, that we can relive it through the transference relation, or at least exert some influence over it. My aim today, however, is to critically interrogate this basic assumption by questioning a similar suggestion that's also been made, that this was the hidden purpose behind Nietzsche's notion of the eternal recurrence of the same, that this was its liberating power, that to truly engage with this most terrible thought of endlessly repeating your life over and over again, you must engage with the very idea of actually living your life over and over again. Only by doing this emotionally, intellectually, existentially, can you find some way of reconciling yourself with who you really are. A reconciliation in the fullest sense of the word, perhaps, that by reconciling yourself with every thought, every action or event that has brought you to this very moment in the here and now, you can live your life over and over again in some kind of peace, through some kind of resolution, thereby putting it behind you. An early brand of existentialism, some might say. To conduct my interrogation of this idea, I will start where Nietzsche started. When Nietzsche introduced his conception of the eternal return, he first spoke of it as a what-if. With this decisive manoeuvre, he very deftly closed the gap between its status as a purely speculative thought and what we might consider the real event. This left many interpreters in a quandary about its exact import, however. Should the eternal recurrence be regarded as some kind of cosmological event in the first instance? Especially since Nietzsche himself described it, and Spasten was referring to this earlier, as the most scientific of all possible hypotheses, and even went so far as to seek various scientific proofs for his big idea. Yet, on the side of metaphor and pure speculation, there's an equally compelling argument for the eternal recurrence to be viewed as more of a psychological gambit on Nietzsche's part, designed purely to play with your mind and ultimately provoke the most acute reflection on the meaning of our lives, to reflect comprehensively beyond any notion of good or evil on all our past sins and failings. What's striking about Nietzsche's employment of such a what-if in the context here of Freud's house, I was actually writing this thinking I was going to be a couple of doors down, is that we must inevitably consider this idea of the eternal recurrence as a psychopathological manifestation as well, which leads us to consider the fact that what-ifs also feature in the formation of obsessional symptoms, according to Freud. There is a popular view, at least in the contemporary clinical field, that OCD is best considered as a thought disorder in the first instance. This is sometimes termed magical thinking in the literature, where an idle thought, or an intrusive thought as it's more often termed, is suddenly imbued with both magical but also highly destructive powers. If we look at these thoughts in detail, as Freud invariably did, it operates linguistically on the future anterior. These what-ifs operate retrospectively, as if the event has already happened. They have a retrospective inevitability built into them. And because of this inevitability, something needs to be done urgently to prevent their happening. And this is where the obsessional symptom comes to the rescue. These magical thoughts operate along the same lines as the wording of a spell or some form of spoken prophecy, borrowing as it does from the English idiom, don't tempt fate. For example, if we speak about something bad happening to somebody, that actually we might well cause it to happen. The emphasis in this dictum is on the expression don't and don't tempt fate, since the key to its action is the function of prohibition, the no of the father, the result of a failed attempt to put a bar over desire. What Freud came to observe is how a whole set of countermeasures get implemented to combat these terrible thoughts. Since these what-ifs can indeed tempt fate, these countermeasures are intrinsic to what Freud termed the diphasic operation of the symptom, i.e. there are two phases, diphasic in their construction. Every terrible thought must be neutralized, kept in check, by an equally powerful counter-thought, generally expressed in the form of some compulsive action, a kind of exorcism in effect. Freud's patient, the Rackman, developed countless rituals to combat these intrusive thoughts, since he believed in the magical power of his counter-thoughts. Unfortunately, he also believed in his own prophetic powers, which created the necessity for extremely powerful counteractions to be employed. He once mused that if his father died, he would become rich enough to propose to the girl of his dreams. And in accordance with his magical beliefs, the manifestation of this idle thought led immediately to the death of his father some months afterwards. Intrinsic to this reaction was the causal relation that existed between the what-if and the real events that were inevitably set into motion. The moral of every obsessional story is always be careful what you wish for. It is these continued attempts to combat what lies ahead in our lives that functions at the very heart of the repetition compulsion. It rests on a paradox. You must act now to stop the inevitable happening. It hinges on the uniquely human notion that we have some control over our destiny, or at least there is something we can call upon to prevent the worst happening, particularly the traumatic interruption of the real into the tranquility of our lives, the very tranquility the pleasure principle insists on. But, as we know, there is something beyond the pleasure principle. There is always some dark demon at play, trying to muck things up. Freud cited a range of religious practices that have this same function, each ritualized action designed to ward off evil or any bad luck that might befall us. If we repeatedly do this or that, and the more often the better, we don't just atone for our past sins, we ensure nothing bad happens in the future. It operates as if it were the most profound form of insurance policy, protecting us against any future calamity. Now, the real paradox is this. Repetition is designed to prevent repetition. Obsessional symptoms are designed specifically to combat the eternal recurrence of the same. And I will go on to elaborate further on this fundamental paradox. Of course, if something bad does occur, as it often does in life, this rarely exposes the flawed foundation of this magical belief system. In fact, it strengthens it. If the inevitable does happen, it's usually because you didn't get it right in the first place, which then means you must try harder next time. Guilt plays its crucial part in sustaining this belief system, as it often does in religion, and neurosis, of course, since religion is premised on the assumption that bad events reoccur precisely because you failed in some filial duty to the big other, i.e. you didn't obey the primordial law of the father. The neurotic life, for the obsessional at least, is about getting it right. Except it turns out to be more of an art than a science. There is no method to this madness. You just have to keep on practicing until you get it right. Only then can you liberate yourself from the paralyzing grip of the past. This is the belief system that operates at the very heart of repetition compulsion. Only by correcting past mistakes can you get life right. But, and this is a big but, you can only alter the past fractionally, infinitesimally. And because of this rule that comes with a weight of the past, it must take us an infinite number of cycles to get things right, more than a lifetime even. Yet the slim possibility that you can indeed change your destiny just a bit is enough to sustain the infantile illusion that we still have some kind of narcissistic mastery over our lives. And based on this slim possibility that we can magically influence our destiny comes the faint hope that we can indeed combat any future trauma. When Jacques Lacan identified repetition as one of the four fundamental concepts of psychoanalysis, He argued that repetition, in its neurotic form at least, relies heavily on the differential quality of the signifier for its functioning. The symbolic faculty we humans are furnished with allows us to play endlessly with how we represent the same thing to ourselves, again and again in a multitude of different ways. Everything is allowed to slip and slide through the operation of signification, as the very agency that ushers in the dimension of alienation and separation into our lives. We can be both different, but also the same as our parents. This means we don't have to relive their exact same life, make the same mistakes as them, or at least we hope. This is also how the subject comes to express their so-called individuality. What Lacan endeavours to show us in Seminar 11, however, is that repetition operates primarily at the symbolic level, not the imaginary, as the object relations tradition have vehemently argued. Repetition is not about the image of the object, it's about the story of the object, the neurotic's individual myth, as Lacan preferred to phrase it. This had decisive implications for the handling of transference analysis as well. Freud had made it clear that the transference relation was not an identical reproduction of some past image in the present. It is merely a facsimile or cliché, as Freud characterised it. More often than not, there is just a trait that the analysand hinges their feelings upon in the analyst. Therefore, transference allows endless variations of a theme. It can be the same, yet also different. So in terms of our discussion here today, repetition, at least in the sense Lacan implies, is not about repeating the exact same thing again and again, since the very differential quality of the signifier always accommodates some degree of variation. In other words, it operates in stark contrast to Nietzsche's idea of perpetual recurrence of the same thing. In contrast to Freud, Nietzsche tells instead that everything will happen again in the exact same order. It would be more correct to say there is only one cycle, since all subsequent cycles are identical. There is no room for variations, no interruptions can occur between each repetition. What you do in one cycle has no impact on the next, or as Nietzsche put it, we will be in the world only once, and that by no imaginable chance for a second time. Neurotic repetition, by contrast, offers us the faint possibility of salvation, a second chance. The eternal recurrence, however, is about reliving the exact same life. Identical in every respect, no possibility of altering your fate. This is the terrifying power of his ideas, which is why his great idea is indeed the obsessional's worst nightmare. The very idea that you're destined to become a stranded victim of fate, strapped in the roller coaster of life with no choice as to where you're going to end up. But I use the term quite advisedly here, since the nightmares that usually follow a trauma are those where the individual replays the same scene again and again and again. Nightmares are still dreams, of course, and dreams operate on the side of the symbolic, which is why they always contain a modicum of hope, a disguised wish. But despite this, nightmares were a puzzle for Freud initially. What terrible wish could be represented in such dreams? Were they the products of some kind of counter-wish, aimed at mastering something terrifying, overwhelming? Or were they simply wished for a different outcome, even? In support of Lacan's argument for repetition operating on the side of the symbolic, as the very thing that facilitates the function of the what-if that operates on each and every one of our individual histories, he capitalises on the signifiers inscribed in the dream of the burning child that Freud presented for us originally in the interpretation of dreams. The subject of the recurrent dream wakes up each time at the same juncture, the very moment he encounters his son just before he dies. Freud's interpretation emphasises the father's wish to preserve this moment, the wish for the son to still be alive, born of his father's great regret, if only he could have saved his beloved son's life. But Lacan draws our attention to something else in the dream, something that operates outside the frame. Outside the scene of the burning child, in its margins, is a mist encounter that frames the image, namely the simple fact that the father never got to see his son before he died, The phrase that repeats and brings the dream to a sudden end is, "Father, can't you see I'm burning?" And so Lacan places a different emphasis on the present tense conveyed in the phrase, "Can't you see?" which offers a completely different inflection on the significance of the image. The father can at last see his son. And so, through the vehicle of the dream, the missed encounter is made up, the gap is closed. This father seeks the ever-elusive moment of closure through the medium of his nightmare. The speculative space that the symbolic provides offers him a time-defying manoeuvre to return and have another chance. This allows the story to get rewritten in this other space, in some future interior, but only momentarily, only very slightly. It's about striking a deal with fate. This is the compromise, to be caught in this endless return. For Lacan, it is this form of human failure that lurks behind every nightmare, revealing the all-too-human component that drives the repetition compulsion. The Tuca, my French is very poor.
Tichy.
Tichy, right. The Tichy of the missed encounter, the chance piece of fate that implicates the subject each and every time they return to the same place, to something they missed, but they know not what, something they should or shouldn't have done, hinting at the bedrock of unconscious guilt that this huge edifice is built upon. Freud also identified as the source of the punitive superego that lies at the very heart of the obsessional pathology. What also became even more apparent in all this is how the living and the dead are intertwined in the repetition, coexisting, as it were, in the same space, the same looped time continuum that keeps everything past, present and future in suspended animation. The dead, as such, are literally stranded in time, like the ghost of Cathy Earnshaw in Wuthering Heights, clamouring, screaming to get into the house through the closed window. A variety of Hollywood films have tried to exploit this same theme of endlessly reliving a nightmare. What these narratives play on is the abiding notion that we can change our destiny through some subtle manipulation of the past. Most famously, this is depicted in the film Groundhog Day. Sebastian mentioned it earlier. Which is often referenced in relation to Nietzsche's idea of eternal recurrence as it happens. Quite wrongly, I would argue, since there is a fatal flaw in its narrative, the main protagonist, played by Bill Murray, does finally find a way of lifting the curse of his eternal recurrence by satisfying the obsessional's dictum that through endless trial and error you can indeed get it right and thereby free yourself from the grip of the eternal recurrence. But I repeat again, this is not what Nietzsche's eternal recurrence of the same is really about. For Nietzsche, it's actually Groundhog Day forever. The only scene from the film that touches on the true implication of Nietzsche's great thought is the following, where the main character wakes up each morning in the full knowledge that he's indeed living the eternal nightmare, the perpetual recurrence of the same. I'm just going to play a tiny clip for you, but I think I've got to set it off. It won't work with this, or I'll jump. There's a little kind of, if you wiggle around on the screen, it'll show a little play button. The other worry is that the sound won't play. See, there's such enjoyment in the smashing of this, and I've spoiled it. You can't hear it very well.
Sonny and Cher.
Sonny and Cher. I got you, babe. Of course, he doesn't get the girl, does he? Here we are, another day again. Oh, that face says it all. A more recent Hollywood blockbuster from 2011 that to my mind has even more of an obsessional theme is the film Source Code. Hunky Jake Gyllenhaal plays the unsuspecting hero, an American soldier who gets sent back in time by his superiors. With the help of some computer trickery, hence the title of the film, they play with the source code of time. They then give him a brief 8 minutes to find a bomb that's about to explode on a busy commuter train. I don't know if you're familiar with this film at all. Each attempt he makes is unsuccessful. The bomb blows up and he dies, whereupon he gets sent back in time to the same point to try once again. There are moments in this film where he seems quite resigned to his fate, as in the following scene. Of course, it's not okay. You have to learn that. Okay? After the point in the film, he seems a little more determined to give it one more try, encouraged by the muse he falls in love with. Another clip. Sorry, Ivan. I bet you're regretting I've returned into your life.
No, no, he deserves it.
I'd make those seconds count. The young existentialist in me, that's how I interpreted the eternal recurrence initially. That age has changed my view. The most relevant detail of the narrative of this film that relates to our discussion today is the fact that the authorities have sent him back with a very specific instruction. They insist he cannot deviate from this rule, namely that his mission is to simply locate the bomb and report back anything that might reveal the identity of the terrorist. This is because the terrorist has announced there is another bomb due to go off at some future moment. It's this second trauma they're trying to prevent, not the first. In other words, he mustn't detonate the first bomb, as this will disrupt the sequence of fate. But of course, this is Hollywood. The mythic narrative takes over. Jake Gyllenhaal has quite different ideas about his destiny and is compulsively driven to test the limits of this theory of the eternal recurrence of the same. He must change his fate. And so the mythic hero comes to save the day. He ends up defusing the bomb and, of course, gets the girl. And having liberated both himself and the woman he loves from their terrible fate, everything ends up on a kind of moment of closure. Those familiar with the Ratman story might also see some obvious parallels here about trying to kind of save a woman. It's been noted the English word repetition is a rather poor translation of the German term, and again my German is very poor, Wiederholung, that Freud originally used. Whilst the English word repetition connotates something automatic, habitual, devoid of existential anguish or human meaning, the word Wiederholung has a much richer connotation. It alludes to the all-too-human tendency to drag things up, revisit things endlessly, of a subject haunted continually by something uncanny, plagued endlessly by something stuck in his past, something they are continually being reminded of, yet something that remains curiously unknown to them, haunts them. There's something that questions their very existence in the truly dialectical sense. It interrogates them. This is what it might be like to be stuck in purgatory, perhaps. And so if we read Freud's Ratman case quite closely, we discover that there were chance pieces of fate that had structured his father's destiny long before he was born. The yet to be born and the dead are intertwined again. If we utilise Freud's original term Wiederholung instead of repetition, it lends much more substance to the wished-for resolution of the film's source code exemplifies. It returns us to the all-too-human impulse that inspires the obsessional act, driven as it is by this unconscious sense of guilt, which persists with the subject's life as the very human yearning for the much-needed resolution to this endless anguish, a yearning for reparation even. All this facilitated to any of the myriad forms of symbolic closure that our creativity affords us, this being the eternal function of myth, I would argue. Prompted, as they often are, by the chance occurrences in life, this human subject is compelled, driven in fact, to return again and again to the scene of the crime, to dredge things up each and every time they're reminded. They're chasing the impossible in some infinite time loop, an endless attempt to try and put something to rest. The important thing to remember, however, is that while repetition always operates on the side of remembering, of dragging things up, it is ultimately aimed at forgetting. It is that unfortunate gap in the fabric of the individual's narrative that yearns for closure. Again, you just need to return to the case of the rat man to see this perpetual mechanism at work. For the rat man is indeed living his own nightmare. He is the very definition of a tortured soul, endlessly returning to the same scene of his past demeanours, usually bringing with him the moral question, what should I have done? Or alternatively, what shouldn't I have done? He oscillates between the both in his symptoms. And speaking of torture, we could do well to remind ourselves of the Ratman's account of hearing the story of the rat torture from the captain, whereupon the Ratman exclaimed privately to himself, at that moment, the idea flashed through my mind that this was happening to a person who was very dear to me. The absolute terror conjured up by this intrusive thought that he might indeed be responsible for the pain of another gets linked up, rather spuriously I should add, with a whole substrata of already established thoughts. Thoughts attached to events stretching right back into his childhood, and then stretching even further back into his prehistory, to his father's life before he was born, long before his father met his mother. Events and actions that questioned the very reason why his parents met in the first place. What if they hadn't met? What had brought them together? And so we lead ultimately to the very question of the desire of the other. Endless reminders of these unanswered questions kept on coming thick and fast to question his very being. What I'm saying is that these past associations get progressively dragged up and then brought to bear on the present moment. That it's only in the present tense that you can change things. Wow, did you hear the cat? No. The urgency of the present tense compels the rat man to pay the lieutenant back for the postal charges that are by now long overdue. Only in this way could he change the order of fate, just like the soldier in the source code. He had to stop something happening at some future point. Only by repaying this debt, and thereby his father's debt, could he avert the inevitable chain of events that would lead to this terrible rat torture being inflicted on somebody he loved. Except factually, by now, this was impossible. His moment had passed. It turns out that the whole host of events had occurred since the debt was incurred, which Freud was keen to explain by means of the following little map. I don't know how familiar you are with this little map. I won't go into the detail of what this convoluted map was designed to explain. Freud must have had endless patience listening to this stuff. Like everything pertaining to the rat man, it's just far too complicated. Suffice to say, basically says that A is no longer at Z or Z. And with this realization that he could not change fate came the dreaded implication that it was no longer possible for the rat man to clear his debt. The train had indeed passed, his fate was already sealed, and the execution of the rat torture was a fait accompli. Yet, and this is the astonishing thing, despite this temporal obstacle, the rat man remained resolute because he has the special facility for magical thinking at his disposal. despite these inconvenient facts that stand in his way, he can still avert this terrible event, since it exists in a future anterior, as does everything else, in some other space. By manipulating this space, he and he alone possesses the awesome power to avert this terrible fate. What we observe in the sentence that gave birth to this terrifying sequence of events, that this was happening to a person who's very dear to me, is a very special form of synchronic determination that is only feasible through the grammatical organization of language. Only language offers the possibility of rewriting history. Language is an active entity, as Lacan continuously noted. Language has, he says, a sort of retrospective effect in determining what is ultimately decided to be real. But beyond this, as he informs us in his Rome Discourse in 1953, what is realized in my history is the future anterior as what I will have been. Get your head around that. Perhaps this is a weak way to put it, but it's as if we are living our entire life in a peculiar dimension where time is running backwards to an event that has already happened. The point being that time doesn't simply work in one direction. It prescribes a circular dialectic, back and forth, alternating between past, present, and future. This dialectical functioning relies on a perpetual beyond, another space, another dimension, you could call it, that endlessly disrupts the logic of our conventional notion of time. More than this, it opposes the linear logic of the drives as well, since it operates against the vested interests of the pleasure principle. Freud could only conceive this dialectical functioning as a theoretical possibility, a speculation essentially, as an as-if, a necessary speculative jump that he made in Beyond. I'm sure Tonyos will talk more about this maybe. To make sense of his clinical intuition about what was going on. This speculative leap led to an equally terrifying notion of something operating outside or beyond the pleasure principle. Many have struggled with this speculation. How on earth could this be possible? It's counterintuitive. Some prefer to call it the death drive, but it's only a drive towards death if we think of it as something counter to a conventional way of seeing time and causality. Or as Freud expressed it, the it precedes the I. And so what I'm saying is that Freud's speculation functioned the same way as Nietzsche's eternal recurrence, as a thought experiment, a what if, that allows something radical to manifest itself in the symbolic. A speculative necessity that defies our linear conception of time and causality. It gives us the radical idea that we're not just living one life in one direction. There is an unseen real that operates outside the frame. We continually see its scientific proof in the repetition compulsion especially. Lacan also theorized this outside of the rim as the lost object, the object little a. But not just as an object, also a space, a lack that's also a surface, an ulterior surface, the remnant, the residue that's left behind by the lost object. An object space perpetually out of grasp, repeatedly missed, a lost and forgotten love. If only we could get back to it, draw nearer to it, bring it back, recover it somehow, and thereby close the loop by being reunited once again. I'm okay for time, aren't I? Well, I've struck a deal with Elizabeth. She says I can run on a little bit.
So, the deal's going on behind my back. Okay.
Yeah, sorry. So
little change.
Quite. So maybe it's me you wanted me to go. So anyway, it's notable that both in the uncanny and beyond the pleasure principle, Freud approached the question of repetition through the lens of trauma specifically. That what gets repeated in our lives is the result of an aspect of the trauma that which can't be assimilated. That something remains forever out of reach. The eruption of the real leaves a curious residue, a remainder that is ever so slightly outside the reach of the symbolic. It leads to a temporal omission, or something can be recorded in so-called real time, and so forever after the subject remains incomplete, searching, looking back in time to a future anterior. Only through Freud's daring consideration of trauma as such a failure to represent, but also as a kind of temporal anomaly, did he find a way of conceiving the circular mechanism underlying the duplex nature of the drive? Repetition endlessly circles around those bits that have failed to achieve representation. To appreciate this, we must locate its action beneath the curve of its return, on the hidden side of the Mobius strip, as the result of a retrogressive wish, a perpetual desire to return to a moment that has passed, the crucial juncture just prior to a traumatic event, that 8 short minutes prior to the explosion going off. This is because the afterwardsness of the event, Nachtraglichkeit, and repetition are intimately linked, dialectically intertwined. Repetition plays, in the ludic sense of the word, on the oscillation between the impossibility of rewriting history and its endless possibility. Repetition demands the new, as Lacan says. Which brings us neatly back to the what-if of Nietzsche's own idea of the eternal recurrence of the same, as a similar theoretical construct, destined to open up another space, a looped dimension, designed to play with something that is perpetually out of grasp, that other space where language and myth throws out a lifeline to the human subject, which the subject desperately grabs hold of, in the vain hope of hauling himself out of the abyss of this eternal replay. Final bit. It's therefore worth reminding ourselves that the practice of psychoanalysis cannot alter the past in the way the obsessional hopes for. Instead, it offers a radical alternative, the compulsion that rules their lives. The analytic aims instead towards moving the analyst very gradually, and usually with great resistance, towards accepting a certain responsibility for the fact that, to use Nietzsche's expression, thus I willed it. That we can only come to truly accept our own compulsion to repeat by accepting our part in its action. This is about embracing our symptom and what these powerful entities have shaped us into. Our symptoms are the product of some long-lost prior determination, looping back on us endlessly. In the first instance, this trajectory leads us towards an assumption of our past history, but equally, in reverse, temporally speaking, it leads us towards a liberating assumption of our own destiny. Which leads me towards my final question today. Was this the true lesson of Nietzsche's idea of the eternal recurrence of the same? Since it offers us the most radical yet non-religious path towards redemption, the most affirmative form of redemption for all our past sins. This assumption, this affirmation of our individual myth and the myths that come to structure our lives, offers the obsession in particular another way out of this living nightmare, where he can become, in the ontological sense of the word, the exact same opposite of Nietzsche's image of the pale criminal, the hollowed-out figure that broods endlessly over each and every one of his past demeanours, the person, as Zarathustra said, that cannot bear its image after it is done. Nietzsche, I would venture, knew this figure well. I'm not making a diagnosis for Nietzsche, by the way. Negation's a very useful trick. A figure tortured by an unconscious sense of guilt for harbouring such terrible thoughts, but also the continued ambivalence towards all that is good, all that is lovable, urged on by a sadistic monster that gnaws away at our soul, just like the rats gnawing at your anus in the Ratman's fantasy. It's all about embracing the monster, integrating it, not fighting it. The Kleinian tradition prefers to depict this epic battle in different terms, of an irreconcilable conflict between good and evil, or at least the good and bad object. The bad object as the result of a split off sadistic impulses directed towards the loved object, which then sets into motion the work of reparation and thereby the work of analysis, as an endless process of integrating these split off impulses, these part objects, into some mythic idea of a whole, or at least some semblance of a whole that can sustain the subject, thereby ushering in the so-called depressive phase. And you might well wonder if the eternal recurrence is merely another expression of Klein's depressive phase. But whichever way you look at it, what these versions of analysis embody for us in the fundamental idea that there is nothing you can do about your fate, confirming as it does the first dictum of the eternal recurrence according to Nietzsche, which becomes, and I'm quoting here, the highest formula of affirmation, a Dionysian affirmation of the world as it is, without subtraction, exception, or selection. It wants eternal circulation, the same things, the same logic and illogic of entanglements. If we truly engage with Nietzsche's statement, the goal of analysis, perhaps, according to this formula at least, is to become that which does not want to be otherwise. Thank you.